Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I'm Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilber, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects. Let's start with an easy question. Have either of you made yogurt before?
I've made a lot of yogurt in my life, like a lot, like probably metric tons worth of yogurt.
David, you know, I make kefir a lot, and that's easy because you can keep it at room temperature and just let it, you know, sit overnight, and it turns into a nice thick fermented drink. But what's the process for yogurt?
Yogurt? If you want to make it really well, I mean, in a wild ferment, you'll find dozens of species living in there. But, you know, for those starter cultures that are racehorses that ferment very well, you'll find kind of two main bugs in there. Streptococcus thermophilus, the gram-positive fermentative facultative anaerobe, and Lactobacillus bulgaricus, which is, since it was first discovered, has been renamed Lactobacillus delbrueckii subspecies bulgaricus, another gram-positive anaerobe. Bulgaricus, you know, it's named after the topic of today's episode, which is Bulgaria. Initially discovered in 1905, by the microbiologist Stamen Gigorov, and then was popularized by Ilya Meshnikov, an immunologist who was based in Paris, who isolated it from Bulgarian yogurt. He had this hunch that, you know, there are so many centenarians, people living to ripe old ages, very healthily, you know, this is over 100 years ago, in the mountains of Bulgaria. He went there to investigate what was responsible for that long life. And he looked into the food that they ate every day, yogurt, and discovered this little microbe that he believed was counteracting, you know, this all of the negative pathogenicity in their environment. And so birthed the kind of whole field of probiotics. But that's getting into history. You know, how do you make yogurt? You inoculate milk with these two bugs, or whichever bugs you have on hand that, you know, will make a reliable yogurt culture. And then you keep it warm. You generally keep it, you know, if you're doing this in a homestead, kind of like just off to the side of the hearth in the temperature span where you wouldn't really feel a temperature difference from your own bodily heat to the ambient air in the room, around 35 or 36 degrees, which is what is called the range for mesophilic or middle temperature loving bacteria. And you wait overnight and they eat up all of the milk sugars. They excrete lactic acid as a function of their metabolism, and that acid then coagulates the proteins, making a gel network that binds water and makes for that delicious thick texture that we all know and love.
So yogurt, or, you know, fermented dairy products, were made way before these species were isolated and you could inoculate with something that you knew, some bacterial species that you knew. So how was yogurt made before, and where did the microbes come from? And this is, you know, the topic of today's episode. I think it's a super interesting question. We think about it a lot in the gut microbiome field, because every time an infant is born, just before they're born, their gut is essentially sterile. There are no microbes there, and they're destined to become this organism that hosts trillions of microbial cells, hundreds of species. And so as soon as a baby is born, they orally acquire microbes from their mother's vagina, from her stool microbiome, the skin, the environment, and it results in this succession, this kind of development of a microbial community over the ensuing weeks, months, and years. And so if you extrapolate to fermented foods, you know, I have here some green tomatoes that I fermented from my garden. You know, what do you do at the end of the season when you have a bunch of green tomatoes that aren't going to ripen? Well, you can chop them up and throw them into a jar, and, you know, using David's trusty book that I have here and I use frequently, the Noma Guide to Fermentation, just throw veggies into 2% saline and let them sit. After 5 days, 2 weeks, depending upon the temperature, this cloudy liquid surrounding the veggies, a really delicious flavor. And what you've essentially done is had this microbial community just spontaneously bloom in there. And, you know, it results in really delicious fermented foods. But it comes back to this major question, you know, where are these microbes that are on the tomatoes coming from?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because in vegetable fermentation, our understanding is that these lactic acid microbes that are playing a role in the fermentation are going to be coming from the environment. So from our hands, from the surfaces of the vegetable, which is something that we're going to talk to future guests about. But in yogurt, right, we have this dairy, this milk environment. And so when we're purchasing yogurts, we're used to having two strains that David mentioned earlier that have been added as starters to pasteurized milk. But of course, we've had yogurt and we've had dairy fermentation happening way before we could isolate microbes, before we even knew what microbes were. And so there's a question of just, you know, how did we get these microbes? How did we identify them? What was used as the original starter to start the first yogurt? David, you actually traveled recently with Veronica Sinote, who is a postdoc in Rob Dunn's lab at the University of Copenhagen, and with Sevgi Mutlu-Sirkova, who is a PhD candidate at the LMU Rachel Carlson Center. And you traveled together to Bulgaria to actually research these rituals around yogurt making. Can you give us a little preview of your trip?
Veronica was just chatting to me. We just met up for coffee. We'd known each other for some months at this point. And she let me know that through Rob, she was connected with Sevgi, and they were planning on putting together a little research trip to investigate this relationship between ants and people and cows and plants, and look at these very traditional ways of making yogurt in the mountains of Bulgaria. So she let me know about this trip, and I was the registered documentarian that also helped sanitize all of her lab equipment in the kitchen and, you know, offer up my advice and help cook dinner too. It was an investigation into exactly that question, like, where are these microbes actually coming from? If you're not inoculating with pure culture, they have to be coming from the environment. The practice, from like an anthropological level, is one of these places where the homonym of culture and culture overlap completely, where you're talking about microbial cultures, where you're talking about the actual propagation of strains and germlines and cells. And you talk about human culture and the transmission of practices and traditions and routines. The advent of microbiology, yogurt was not a new thing. It's been something that's been around for thousands of years. And we saw it there firsthand, showing by feel. Nothing was written down. It was all oral history. It was all these like bodily heuristics, like stick your pinky finger into the milk until it bites. And that's how you know it's hot enough to ferment into good yogurt. There was so much metaphor in the way that they talked about this. But it was only through that culture and tradition that you saw basically the good practices of microbiology that then scale up into the industrial food production that I see on a daily basis. You see where those two things overlap. It is those practices and those traditions that allow the actual fermentative bacteria, the ones that you're looking to work through, are there in very small numbers, but it's only through human action and human intent that the entire batch doesn't spoil, as you suppress the pathogens and you suppress the fungi and you suppress all the opportunistic bacteria that you don't want growing through your food. A lot of what we were investigating, and we were investigating multiple ways of making yogurt, you can't necessarily separate superstition from microbiology, but unless you actually look into it and say, okay, well, what microbes are actually in the rainwater? How does this actually affect the outcome? So refreshing yogurt with rainwater was a practice that was still being undertaken. But the other ones, you know, making yogurt by burying milk in an anthill, using nettle roots and pounding them as a source of microbiota. These were practices that even Sevgi's great uncle and great aunt weren't necessarily still doing. They would talk about them as like ancient memories from their childhood, but it wasn't necessarily something they practiced even themselves in their own lifetime. So in a lot of ways, we were kind of re-piecing this fragmented history and trying to, you know, retrace the steps. There was no batch of ant yogurt that we had when we got there. We had to recreate the environment and hope that the right microbes would spring into action by doing so. Let's get into the interview.
Welcome, everyone. Today's guests are Dr. Veronika Sinote and Sevgi Mutlu-Syrakova. Veronika is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Copenhagen's Center for Evolutionary Whole Genomics and works in the lab of Professor Rob Dunn and Associate Professor Sandra Anderson. Sevgi, instead, is a PhD candidate at the Ludwig Maximilian University Rachel Carlson Center in Munich. Welcome to both of you. Sevgi, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and some of the background and interests that have led you to your research?
Hi, everyone. Nice to be here with you. I grew up in a small Turkish village in Bulgaria, where I learned about traditional food practices. These experiences still guide my research. When I was 9, we migrated to Turkey, where I studied biology and have heavily engaged with environmental campaigns and green politics over 15 years. It was during this period I recognized the need for creating a space for traditional practices, for imagining alternatives beyond technological solutions. This led me to focus on fermentation for my second master's degree, which I am continuing in my PhD research. And currently I'm tracing traditional fermentation practices in my home countries, Bulgaria and Turkey, by using ethnographic methods. I am mainly interested in stories about how people used to ferment. And I have privilege to be part of a community that still sustains some of these old traditions. As an insider, my main concern is documenting this gradually disappearing phase of fermentation.
Well, wonderful to have you with us today. Veronika, how about you? Could you tell us a little bit about what you work on and what led you in that direction?
So I am a bit different from Sevgi. I am a biologist. I'm trained in ecology and evolution, and I'm a researcher here at the University of Copenhagen. And my work examines the origins and ecologies of microbes in our fermented foods. So I think about, where do the microbes come from? How do they evolve and interact with each other and things outside of that ferment over time? So I take a bit of a holistic approach. At the center where I work, we think about holobionts. And this term considers all the microbes, but also the animal or the plant, the host the microbes are found in. For example, you could think of the human holobiont as the human body, but also all the microbes and this consortium of microbes within it. So we kind of think about ferments in this way, maybe as an extended holobiont that interacts with us, to think about what holobionts of other animals or plants have shaped our foods through time. So before the microbes were in our foods fermenting, they had to be somewhere in the environment, in the soil or plants or animals. And that's my question, is where in the environment have they originated from? And how do they change when they get into a wild ferment, or how have they been domesticated through time?
And so, okay, wonderful. And so how did you two connect?
Sevgi and I attend an interdisciplinary bi-monthly meeting that is run by Professor Rob Dunn of North Carolina State University. And this gathers everyone thinking about fermentation, biologists, anthropologists, theologists, chefs, and people have an opportunity to share their stories. And it was at one of these meetings I heard Sevgi talking about her project on traditional practices related to yogurt fermentation from Turkey and Bulgaria. And some of these practices incorporate wild starters that we'll talk more about. And that was what got me really intrigued in Sevgi's work.
From my side of the story, I need to mention two names. First, Matthew Booker, a food historian who played a key role in introducing me and my work to Rob Dunn. And there is Rob Dunn himself, who has been incredibly supportive of my research, connecting me with Veronika, David, and the wider community of researchers.
Tell us about your trip to Bulgaria. And this was something that David was involved in too, I believe. So I'd love to hear how this all originated and what led to the trip.
I think it started with Sevgi's story that she shared. around this practice that occurs in the springtime related to a festival. Sevgi, maybe you want to actually introduce your past research on the traditions of fermentation and yogurt fermentation, and then I can explain how I became interested and invited David to come along with us.
Yes, with my pleasure. Like I mentioned before, for my previous master research, I was willing to document the multispecies stories around fermentation. Then I spoke with people in my village in Bulgaria, Novomahala, the same place we visited with Veronica and David. I was amazed by what they were sharing with me. They told me about the diverse methods their grandmothers used to make yogurt. For instance, they mentioned using nettle roots to ferment milk and even utilizing ant colonies as incubators when they were out with their herds. My own grandmother experienced using ant colonies for this purpose about 50 years ago. What's even more fascinating is their use of spring rains to refresh yogurt starters. This practice is still alive today. The season plays a crucial role here. It's during Kadriles, also known as Edrilezi in the Balkans, an ancient festival marking the start of spring. People collect spring rains in early May to revitalize their yogurt stout cultures. This practice has inspired my research, yet I could never have imagined that one day I would be trying them out with amazing experts like David and Veronica.
So I heard about these practices of using the nettle plant or an ant colony, right? All these insects gathered together, or spring rains to start these yogurt cultures. And Sevgi was really interested in these multi-species connections that form the yogurt. So how the people, these ants or plants, and the environment influence the yogurt. And tying all this together are microbes. They seem to be like an invisible thread that impacts each other. And I was really excited about the invisible thread, the microbial ecology that was going on between them. And could we go to these places where Sevgi had done her research and gain this life experience also learning about yogurt? And could I learn more about the microbes and how these different sources may shape yogurt or fermentation? And then David, yeah, how would you say you got involved with this research?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't too long after we'd met. We spoke together at a Mad Monday. So this is NOMA's nonprofit. Well, their mission statement is to improve every meal on Earth for the better. And I was hosting a panel discussion that was quite broad, I suppose, between the three of us. Me as a fermenter, you as a microbial ecologist, and then we had a third guest who was a forest school teacher. And it was a very fertile conversation, you could say. And you brought your leafcutter ants to this Mad Monday that was open to the public. And we kept in touch after that. And yeah, it was over a coffee one day, just catching up on what each of us was working on, that you mentioned this trip that you were about to take with Sevgi. And near the end of that, you mentioned, oh, well, if you happen to know a photographer or an artist that could accompany us, it would be great. There's a little money in the budget to pay for some documentation or some interpretation of what we're going to find. And at that point, I was like, well, you know, I have a camera. And I have moonlighted as a photographer occasionally. And I just jumped at the opportunity to offer my services up. And you were like, you really? And I was like, yeah, I want to come if you'll have me. And it worked out. And I had to beg my partner to take a week off of taking care of our then 8 or 9 month old baby, which she happily obliged. And yeah, we went on the trip, and it was amazing. And I will say that, you know, from my own point of view, I hope I was useful to the two of you in the research, and that the documentarian wasn't someone who was completely blind to the intricacies of how these things work or fit together, you know, it was probably beneficial or added to kind of the symbiosis of even our kind of intellectual foray that I had, you know, my own experience in fermentation and own questions to ask and own kind of even personal research to conduct on that trip alongside recording all these interviews with Sevgi's family, you know, taking pictures of the process of making all of these ferments and hiking up and down the mountain and helping with some lab work with Veronica in the makeshift laboratory that was really just the kitchen. So it was fun. It was honestly one of the most inspiring trips involving food I've ever taken in my life.
Amazing and great insight. If I ever want to get you to go on a trip with me, I just have to have a crazy fermentation something at the end of it. How long was the trip?
The week. It was seven days. Yeah.
So now that you've conceived of this trip, what were important considerations when planning? Because I know Sevgi was your family that you stayed with, that you organized with.
Yeah. I still have a lot of relatives in that village. So we stayed with my aunt. The main consideration was actually to find someone who still has animals and bark near to home. Because unfortunately, in my childhood, every household has its own animals, but not anymore. So I really wanted to find a family that we can go daily to bark for milking with them and observe closely the yogurt fermentation practices with them together.
And so what were the main questions that you even wanted to address? And maybe we can hear from all of you. What was the main interest kind of going in that you personally wanted to look at?
I was interested in where the microbes were coming from. So perhaps I say a bit more about my background. Before I worked in fermented food, I've spent nearly 10 years of an academic or educational career studying the microbes associated with another society, that of social insects. So that means colonies of ants and bees and termites that have been hosting microbes, performing controlled fermentations with these conserved same types of microbes for millions of years. And I was, first of all, really just curious, how could ant microbes be involved in making yogurt? And then stepping back, what is the cultural wisdom that allows for that? As a biologist, I look out into the environment and I see lots of study specimens. I go to the field or the forest and collect these things and then learn about them. But I was going to learn from a group of people and a village that saw these pieces of nature as part of their home that they've incorporated into their practices or rituals or day-to-day life, in particular fermentation. So it was an opportunity not to just learn about ants and their microbes and yogurt, but to see them in a very different light. And I think that shifted a lot of my expectations from what I may normally have going in with a hypothesis and a series of questions to lean back and really listen and observe and absorb what stories or knowledge or details of yogurt or ants or a practice in general that the people of Nova Mahala and Sevgi's family could share with us.
Sevgi, what about you? What did you think through as you were taking these guests to your family's home and bringing other people in?
Yeah, this was something I even wouldn't imagine and still cannot, to going there with Veronica and David. So for me, it's just being such a collaborative project and to be able to experience these practices from her son, because some of them I haven't done by myself as well. So it was great chance to do it together with them. And I didn't have specific expectations, but I was quite excited about the collaboration and to see where it's going to lead us also in near future.
And David, you also have a history of yogurt making from your early childhood. So how was this a different experience from what you were used to when you made your own kind of wild yogurt ferment?
Yeah. I mean, yogurt keeps coming back into my going-ons, you could say. Made a lot of yogurt at the restaurant I worked at back in Canada before I moved to Denmark. It was attached to a little cafe, and we would ferment our own yogurt in the proofer. And, you know, working on brunch shifts, I would have to take it out in the morning and check that it was, you know, ready to go and be handed off. When I worked at Noma, there was a whole season where we had a yogurt dessert on the menu. It was a yogurt mousse that was paired with this kind of poppy seed praline, like this really thick, sweetened sauce of ground poppy seeds that was quite savory, and this super, super delicate yogurt mousse. That yogurt culture came to us from, I guess, not that far away from Bulgaria, from the Caucasus Mountains. It's not the Rhodope Mountains, but the Caucasus Mountains. And it was brought to us by the head winemaker of a natural vineyard, a natural wine label. He was an American Georgian that lived in the States and then went back to Georgia and started this winery. And he knew all of, like, the witchy women who lived in the hills surrounding his winery, who would supply him with ferments and pickles. And there was a culture that he brought with us when he came to visit Noma that was Georgian yogurt that made this beautiful curd. And we kept making it in Denmark for, I think, like 6 months. It was fantastic. But none of that compared to being in Nova Mahala and for the first time in my life, tasting fresh milk straight from a cow's udder and understanding that this resource that in every other restaurant I've ever worked at was something that came out of a square box or a gallon jug that you got from the fridge that had a best before date, that had a date of packaging, that was sealed and sterilized and pasteurized and homogenized, to see for the first time Sevgi's great uncle milk this cow, hand me a cup of frothing, it basically looked like a cappuccino, frothing warm milk that tasted like the best thing on earth. You could taste the grass in this milk. You could taste basically the surroundings that I was smelling, that we were all smelling by being in this new location, in this small village. It really kind of changed and broadened my perception of the relationships between people and landscape and agriculture and how microbes kind of sit at the center of that to produce these amazing things at all. It made every yogurt that I've ever bought from a grocery store seem like a pale simulacrum of this like historical masterpiece that was still being, we talk about this, you know, among ourselves, Sergio and Veronica and I, enlivened and like created and brought into being time after time after time. And after we all, you know, we were given this fresh milking, this fresh milk, like the very second that we arrived in Nova Mahala. But then the following morning, to see this big bucket of milk being whisked into the kitchen and then stirred into a pot of yogurt that would then sit in the corner, and it's like there was no pretense, there was no food safety manual, there was no nothing. It was the most uncomplicated, most natural happening that Sevgi's great aunt just, it's like something that she'd lived 1,000 times before. It was like nothing to her, but at the same time, everything, because she was so happy to do it and show us what she was doing. And just, it's so central in a town like this to Sevgi's family. It really, really broadened my understanding of how kind of delicate and simple, yet at the same time profound, fermentation can be.
So I just want to reflect briefly on what David said. I think it was not just this drastic contradiction to your day-to-day modern industrial interaction with fermented food, but it was this radical experience of sharing. As we entered into the barn, the four of us three researchers visiting, and Mehmet, Sevgi's uncle, we saw a cow and her calf, and that milk first goes to the calf, and it's something that is shared between the calf and the cow, and then the cow and calf kind of looked back at us as we were drinking the milk, sharing in that experience. And then the cats on the barn floor that had been splashed a bit of milk were also sharing in drinking this. And it was like a ceremony to open the day where we shared this incredibly delicious drink and likely lots of microbes. Admittedly, my jacket still smells like a barn. And that was a really different experience than anything I could find on a normal research trip or a typical scientific research trip, I would say. But back to the ants. How do the ants play into the story of yogurt making? I think we should return to Sevgi's knowledge of how was yogurt made using ants traditionally based on your research.
When I was collecting these testimonies, none of my participants, except quite old lady, experienced them by themselves. So they were telling the stories they keep heard of from their relatives and ancestors. So they told me that when they were away from their households, particularly in summer times, with their animals for Apple Hills meadows, they couldn't find enough yogurt to culture their milk. They were using ant colony as incubator. I mean, to just put milk in ant colony to ferment it. But later on, I come across different citations related with from Turkey as well. So it wasn't just the stories I was collecting from my first-hand, but also I was able to trace these traditions in wider historical sources as well. They were mentioning also using ant. Sometimes they were mentioning using ant cocoons, they call it, to smash in their hands and use a starter to refresh the milk, make yogurt.
So they use a very specific type of ant to do this. And the ants employed are what we call red wood ants. And you can find them in the forest. They have this very emblematic redwood ant mound constructed carefully of pine needles or bits of hay. And these are the specific ants that they would use and they could visually identify. And what was exciting about these ants for me, what was cool about the ants is we are just finding out from really new research in the ant field that the ants carry lactic and acetic acid bacteria. And it looks like they have what we call phylosymbiosis. So these ants have been evolving with this lactic and acetic acid bacteria for thousands, maybe millions of years. So my thought was, could that specific ant lactic or acetic acid bacteria be getting into the milk and starting this yogurt fermentation? But like Sevgi said, we had no idea how this was practiced. Actually, none of her family members had ever made ant yogurt. It was something of oral history, of lore, and it was set up for us to recreate.
And so when you walked in and there was the pot of yogurt that was sitting there, how long had that been passaged? When did the original microbial community form to ferment that yogurt? Was that something that's been passed down for years and years? Or is that something that was newer that they had made?
They're black slopping from previous yogurt, for sure. And so their continuation and particularly in springtime, also we experienced this, try to experience it. They are collecting spring rains to refresh the yogurt to be used as starter.
A lot of things that have happened in this conversation so far are fundamental to how we think about fermentation and microbial community development from a scientist perspective. From a making yogurt perspective in the Western world, I mean, I've done this. It's, you know, taking sterilized milk that has no microbes in it and, you know, warming it up and then adding this packet of microbes and that you've purchased from someplace, you know, a set number of microbes. And what I'm hearing from you is this, you know, these are places where they're not buying cultures from from the local culture place. They are out there with dairy product and trying to get the right microbes to grow, or have this wonderful tradition where they end up with this incredible yogurt. And it really gets to this fundamental question that Veronica mentioned earlier, which is like, where do microbes come from that live in microbial ecosystems? And so David, you just mentioned this, you know, passaging into existing yogurt, but, you know, I want to hear about the ants. How do the ants fit into this whole thing?
It's hard to say what role the ants have played in the yogurt making and their fermentation and how they impact the microbial communities now. I think that yogurt made from the ants likely ends up in the pot that's backslopped into the yogurt day to day. And it's not just yogurt that's made with the ants. Sevgi has also heard oral histories, stories of using water from the ant mound to make sourdough bread, or using some of the yogurt and the ant yogurt to make a sourdough starter. So how has this entered into the microbial consortia that's fermenting the food in the kitchen and is part of these people and their food culture is not clear. We have some samples that are in the lab that might give us a peek into that.
And you also tried making ant yogurt while you were all together. So tell us about that.
Yes. We had two trials of trying to make the ant yogurt as we were all beginners, not in yogurt making necessarily, but ant yogurt for sure. The first trial was a bit of a failure. It wasn't particularly delicious, the yogurt, but we learned lessons collectively, not just Sevgi, David, and I, but I think Sevgi's aunt Mushram and her uncle Mehmet learned, and they went into the community and shared these stories about making the ant yogurt, where people asked about us. We weren't the normal faces in the village. And through that week, all of this knowledge bubbled up and, you know, old wisdom was dusted off. And it came into this experience of making a good batch of ant yogurt through our collective wisdom. David, do you want to tell a little bit about making that yogurt, the successful ant yogurt? What was the process of that?
In the first trial, we had a triplicate run where we took the milk from a cow, which was not sterilized or anything. It was heated up until, as Sefji's great aunt let us know, the heuristic there is until it bites your pinky finger. So until it's hot enough to kind of almost scald you if you hold your pinky in for a second or two. It was then poured into glass jars, and we had a big debate, all of us. We were trying to kind of understand what, you know, these familial ancestors or these ancient herders would have done. And the decision was to kind of cap them with a cheesecloth and then kind of secure them so that there would be some ability for microbes to kind of permeate this boundary without getting dirt and pine needles and stuff in. But Veronica, being the diligent scientist that she is, was like, oh, but we need a control. So let's just take the milk that's also been heated up and cap it in a clean jar and put it in there too, completely sealed off. It was chilly in May. This was the beginning of May. And I got to say that, you know, at night, you had to make sure that the windows were shut. We were, you know, cozy under multiple layers of blankets, even inside the house, because it probably dipped down to like 8 or 9 degrees Celsius. That's not a great temperature for making yogurt in any of our experience. But nonetheless, we decided to give it as much time as possible and went back up the mountain the next day, harvested everything out, and were quite disappointed that it didn't really look like anything had set. Like, it was still quite watery, if you can say that. But we took everything back down and then got into the kitchen and started examining what was actually going on. And to our delight, loose curds had formed. And that's good. That's good, because it means that there's enough microbial activity, that there's enough metabolic activity, that we were coagulating some of these milk proteins. It wasn't a firm curd by any means, but we all decided that it's like, okay, well, we can see where this is going. If you'd left it in a little bit longer, it probably would have set. But it was upon tasting the jars that had kind of been open to the air, you could say, that we're like, maybe it's a little bit too wild. Like there were some off notes, I guess you could say, in the flavor of this young yogurt. Some bitter notes, some notes that you would probably associate with microbial contamination of something that should not be growing in a healthy yogurt. It definitely didn't taste like the yogurt that Mushram was making in the house. That was some of the best yogurt I've ever tried. Like tart, but sweet and milky and like set and all of it. These were not that. But nonetheless, it still counted as like a semi-successful experiment in that something was made. And now it would rest on Veronica to take these samples back to the lab to discover what might actually be growing in them. The curveball came when we opened the control and discovered that it had also begun to set. And it was probably the one that tasted the best because it had no access to the outside atmosphere. And this was a big kind of blow to Veronica. I remember your disappointment. You're like, well, this doesn't seem great. And your conclusion is like, maybe the microbes are just coming from the teat of the cow themselves, or just from the jars and the environment or the house. And maybe the microbes from just making normal yogurt in the kitchen are so prevalent that it's just getting into everything anyway. But I realized something kind of wonderful about this whole experiment. And that's the beauty of science, is that even when things don't go according to plan, those are the opportunities to really become surprised and delighted by your findings, you know? And I thought about this, and it was the most beautiful revelation to me. When we went up the mountain, irrespective of introducing ants or the microbes into the milk itself, we buried those jars of milk inside the heart of the ant mound, right? So we opened up the top of the colony, trying to disturb it as little as possible, and placed the jars in. That's what we were instructed to do. That's what Mehmet said that would have been done. And then we covered all of the pine needles back over top. What I'd realized is like, well, given that it was 8 or 9 degrees last night, none of this should have happened. Like, this should have been equivalent to just leaving milk in a grocery store fridge. But nonetheless, something happened. And even though we didn't have temperature probes going inside the mound, it wasn't that advanced an experiment. You know, I asked Veronica about this, and you relayed a really interesting anecdote about a Finnish myrmecologist. Do you want to speak to that, about this famous photograph?
Sure. I'm not sure if it's in Sweden or Finland. The ants are all around the Northern Hemisphere. And in this photo, it's this snowy environment, probably in the early or mid-1900s. Sticking out of it is the ant mound. And there's no snow covering it at all. And there's a man there collecting some ants. I think to make schnapps with ants, per their tradition. And it's because the ant colony itself produces heat. The ants in there and all the microbes that are associated with their nest and the ants themselves, that metabolic activity produces heat. So how does that apply to the yogurt fermentation? Well, by burying a can of milk in an ant colony, the colony itself acts as an incubator. So it could act not only as an inoculum, which is what we were testing, but also increase the temperature to facilitate any fermentation and also keep that temperature steady throughout the fermentation so there's less fluctuation as the day cools or warms up.
So that was kind of an aha moment where we're like, well, even if it's not the microbes themselves that are being transferred, which wasn't completely discounted yet, but obviously there was some reason to think that, well, it was at this point a sample size of 3 trials in one shot with one mound, right?
I also have to say that something I learned from those 3 trials, what I remember, the trial that worked the best was actually Mehmet's yogurt. So Mehmet insisted that his yogurt jar that he placed in the colony, although it was open to the colony microbes through this muslin top, that it should be wrapped up and kept warmer to keep the heat even more steady or insulate the milk. And I think that one was actually the most delicious. So that was a good reminder of one of my aims of the trip, to listen and remember that I know very little about these ants or fermentation.
We were considering it also I was talking with people, I was asking which kind of container they use, because the glass jars, somehow it's new introduction to our region. So probably they used before wooden containers. So we were talking among us as well. And particularly Veronica was asking to find similar wooden containers to try it, but it wasn't possible that time. But it's quite possible that they used different containers that would facilitate the flow of not just microbes, ants itself within milk.
These stories are amazing. But is it true that there's nobody practicing this tradition now? And you're trying to resurrect something based on what people in the village remember maybe their grandparents doing and things like that. So what you're actually doing is kind of certainly an approximation of what used to be done, and maybe not completely right on the money. I mean, you talk about putting gauze to keep the ants out. Is it possible that they were putting it in there in loosely wrapped cloth and the ants were actually accessing the milk and maybe getting a more frank inoculation and then maybe being scooped out later or something like that if they drown in there? I mean, do you have a sense of how close you are in replicating this, and what are the critical gaps you think in knowledge and in how you actually conducted the fermentation?
Yeah, and we learned a bit more because we actually tried again. We had a change in the weather. As David was saying, it was quite cold and crisp. And then at the very end of our trip, on the actual days of the Hildreles, the auburn buds on the trees pushed leaves and stretched out in the spring air. And we thought, it's quite warm out. And I thought, I bet you the ants are buzzing and the colony is heating up. We should try this again. So we all gathered in the kitchen around one jar of milk. And Mishram, Sevgi's aunt, heated up the milk so it could bite her pinky finger with its heat. And then Mehmet told me I should add ants, whole live ants. I should drop them into the milk. So I was thrilled, and I took my container of ants I had collected the day before for fun, as a ant biologist does, and I started to drop ants in, and I could only add four ants, not three, not five. I added four ants into the milk, and we marched up the hill again and buried the jar of milk with its muslin cover in the colony, which was appreciably warmer. It was warm to the touch, and left it in overnight. And the next day we came and picked up the milk, walked back down the mountain and opened it up and saw some light gel-like coagulation again, which left a smile on the faces of all of us, particularly Sevgi's aunt and uncle when they tried it, which was a good sign. But David, maybe you want to tell us what that yogurt tasted like, this last ant yogurt.
It was good. It was the mildest. It was kind of like the most, this is going somewhere in a good direction. And again, the curds were very loose at the start, but nonetheless, if you dipped the spoon in and pulled it out, you would see this loose gel jiggling in your tablespoon. And we were all kind of really happy with how this one turned out. Initially, we're like, we're onto something here. The kicker came when, and this also speaks to being open to the teachings of your elders, Mehmet, seeing that it wasn't completely set, then was like, but we'll turn it into great yogurt. We'll just set it by the fire to give it a little bit extra time. And listening to him, we did. The next morning over breakfast, we came down and we checked on it. We were all expecting to have amazing yogurt now, finally producing the ant yogurt, spending a night in the colony with four ants, no more, no less, put inside with successful curds and a good flavor, kind of, that far into the process was like, this could thread the needle. And we came back and it was like super acidic, bubbly cheese. That tasted very strange. It had simply been too hot by the hearth, and we left it there for too long. So, you know, failures can be very instructive, but it was a success before it was a failure, so.
I was reminded of this interdisciplinary collaboration in our roles and all of it, in people's reactions to the yogurt that had turned into an acidic cheese by the hearth. I think I was almost near tears because I was like, oh, the ant yogurt, I was going to sample the microbes. And this is, you know, it was this penultimate part of the trip for me. Actually, the most important part of the trip was, of course, the experience I shared with everyone. But I remember Sevgi kind of shrugging it off, you know, having her cup of coffee outside and saying, what do you mean? What is wrong? We discovered how to make the yogurt, and we did it together, and we revived this practice, which is really a name of it. And I think David was maybe the Goldilocks, or he was in between, somewhat upset about it, probably because of the curiosity of tasting it again and seeing how the fermentation had shifted, but also realizing that was part of the process of learning, and we had found out the most important part of the story, the steps involved in this fermentation process itself.
And so how has this trip shaped the way in which you think of the role of insects or the insect microbiome in fermented food? And I'm sure, Veronica, you're more familiar with it, but I don't know if, you know, David or Sevgi now think of it differently, or even thinking of, like, you know, David, are you interested in sprinkling ants or finding some other insect, bees, that might play a role in, you know, other ferments?
Well, I mean, Rob Dunn is a little bit like the spider silk that binds us all together. In a coffee with him 2 or 3 years ago, he sent me some papers that talked about how the microbes that are responsible for making things like mead and like spontaneously fermented wines actually overwinter in the digestive tracts of like hibernating bees and wasp species. And that when they go back out in the spring and you know, either forge a new colony or get back out to foraging, when their mouthparts interact with fermentable food sources, sugar sources, that's the reintroduction of those microbes that would otherwise not survive the winter or be, you know, frozen to death, or their cells might have lysed or something like that. It's like a safe space for them. Doing it firsthand really made me view animalia at large, whether those are insects, people, cows, as like these interplanetary spaceships for microbes. And it really made me kind of question just to what extent the microbes are influencing our behaviors. And I'm not talking on the level of like cordyceps, like zombie mind control. Even just these gentle nudges of, hey, I'll make a flavor you love, or I will give you something you need if you can bring me back into existence again and again and again. And it really kind of speaks to these, I think I used a word like an entwinement, like how to make a thick and lasting rope, something that could pull a plow. You take all these individually very weak threads, but threads nonetheless, and then wind them and wind them and wind them around each other again and again and again until you can't really differentiate one from the other. But together you end up with something that's stronger than any one thread. And it really made me very viscerally see this embodied. We were living it, we were taking part in it, we were recreating it. That these ecologies and these kind of coming togethers of animals and the landscape, you know, we didn't even talk about that, how the ants themselves, if you think of an anthill as an incubator, they have to literally forage the landscape, forest dead flies and fruit and, you know, leftovers and caterpillars and all sorts of things, bring it back to their colony, and then enact their own kind of microbial symphony to drive the body heat of this superorganism that allows us to ferment this milk at all. It is literally the land transformed. And that's just one aspect of it. One rope. And there's the human rope and the rope of the cattle. And so all of that really kind of made me see microbes as, you know, not to make them out to be Machiavellian or conspiratorial, but these like kind of grand architects of this whole design, because they sit in the center of it all. And even though they're the smallest players, it somehow makes it seem like they're the most important ones.
I really like this very romantic idea of microbes being this central signal to all of life. But there's also this idea that I struggle with from more of the metabolomic side as someone who's looking into characterizing this chemical landscape of fermented food. And that is that our bodies are just really attuned to picking up microbial metabolites because microbes are on everything. And some of these signals might be shared between us and them, you know, and our bodies produce them and the microbes produce them. So they're indistinguishable to us, you know, what the origin of some of these are. And so I love the idea of tapestry, but, you know, microbes are not aware of you. They're just doing their thing and you're going along in the signaling ride as they produce metabolites as byproducts of fermentation that can be recognized by other microbes and by our bodies, sometimes as flavor, because flavor is just, you know, a way in which our body is able to understand the world around it. And so when you're tasting these yogurts and noticing all these differences in flavors, you know, you've made all of them with the same milk. You've buried them in the same anthill. You've used the same equipment to make them. And I think the fact that you pick up on these differences is so fascinating. I mean, just the slight differences in environment, you know, you have slight temperature change because you're doing all this in the same space, but it's really impacting their fermentation potential, their actual metabolism. And so it changes the signals drastically. And I think that's just so fascinating. If you were to go back and try this one more time, what methods do you think you would change?
I would vote for doing it a little bit later in the year. The ant yogurt specifically. We also refresh yogurt starter with rainwater, as is kind of tradition around Hydrilaz. And that was the yogurt that worked the best. That yogurt tasted phenomenal. And we can kind of understand why, but, you know, Sevki in her article even writes about how rainwater has its own microbiome when you really look into it. And so, you know, it really kind of speaks to the complexity of the landscape again. But I remember messaging a friend, he's also a chef, but kind of really follows in a similar track to Sevji, about the kind of food history and ethnography of a closely related but faraway region in Albania and North Macedonia. And he does a lot of work kind of in the Northern Baltic, retracing a lot of these food traditions himself. And when he heard about what I was doing, he was like, oh, but I've heard whispers from herders here about, you know, ant yogurt. He's like, again, no one does it anymore, but I've definitely heard people talk about this something as something that was done. So it's not something that even seemed specific to just this time or this place. But again, these borders between all these nations are very recent inventions. People had shared culture and relations and pathways for, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years in these regions before anyone decided to call Nova Mahala Bulgaria or, you know, Kosovo, Macedonia. So my one thing, I would try to do it kind of in the height of summer and see if that added solar energy falling on the landscape really pushes the microbes within the ant colony to kind of kickstart the fermentations that much faster.
I would also try to include this different containers as well. It would be a difficult task to find what were they were using, which kind of wood or maybe clay containers, I don't know. It requires a little bit more work about tracing maybe archaeological ones as well. So I would also use different types of containers.
I think I have loads of biological questions I would love to answer. Like you were talking about metabolites, Elisa, when we were first talking about these threads or braids or how do microbes connect to different organisms? I could think about how do these lactic acid bacteria produce lactic acid in the ant's stomach and ferment their food for them? Is it delicious to the ants? Are they using their collective stomach to ferment their food and spread their food around, just like we then share that bacteria from the ants and use it to ferment our yogurt to produce lactic acid, which we find delicious? There's questions like that, and some of them can be answered there. Some of them can be answered in the lab, or we're lucky to also have these types of ants in Copenhagen. I can tell you that from research we're doing with Denmark's Technical University and Restaurant Alchemist's R&D team here in Copenhagen, we've just found out that ants in the later summer months may have more lactic acid bacteria than in springtime, per David's suspicion. So they may be better fermenters or starters at that time of year when the colony is warmer. So that would be exciting to try. What I would really like to do, if I had an opportunity to go back, was to involve more people in the community with the guidance of Sevgi and her family, because essentially this is where all this wisdom, this is where this practice originated, and that's what allowed for all of these findings. So to create a broader shared experience that would help guide us to pick the right type of wooden barrel. For example, her neighbor down the street, who is well into his 80s, was a herder who in the very end of our trip, he told us that he had actually done this as a herder in that time. So could we talk to him and have him involved? Or to draw on some of this wisdom, some of this knowledge, some of the whispers from the area, like David had talked about. In eastern Turkey, there's a woman that's a chef and a fermenter that has discussed on YouTube and through different videos and postings recipes for making ant yogurt, where she uses the ant cocoons and she crushes the ant cocoons in the milk and uses like a 3-day period for it to turn into something that looks like a cheese. It's kind of like a mascarpone, maybe a little bit over-rennetted soft cheese, and then uses that as the starter for the yogurt, right? So you make this little ant dairied ball that then starts the yogurt practice. And this is from a different area, probably different ants. But what happens when you bring more chefs into the mix, or more anthropologists or everyday people that know about the practice, and what can be learned there, and how can we pass it on and make sure that this practice isn't forgotten, right? We aren't gathering a group of people that don't know anything again to try to revive ant yogurt or nettle or spring water yogurt at this very special time, the sacred time of the year.
So what's next? I know you have all these samples that you want to process in lab, but you also have a lot of photos and videos. So what are you going to do with all of these? What's next for each of you?
Well, I'll be in the lab. We've isolated some exciting bacteria from the ants and the ant yogurt and the nettle that are actually present in a lot of modern day ferments. And disentangling that evolutionary history, what does the kind of tree of life of that bacteria look like as it goes from ants to ferment? Or how are the microbes in the ants shaping the yogurt? Are they perpetuated in the household yogurt? Can we detect them in the household yogurt? Or maybe even just a question on a shorter timeline, how do the cow's teats shape the yogurt fermented in the house? So these are the types of questions that I'm working on in the lab here now.
And for me, I'm looking forward for these results to just reveal, to see what is the diversity of microbes that was in this experimental yogurts. Because we know that there was a study actually on homemade yogurts by Bulgarian microbiologist led by Velikova and her team in 2018. They found 76 different strains of lactic acid bacteria, only lactic acid bacteria, 76. So some of them, they call it, just belong this region, they name it as endemic microflora. So I'm really waiting to see results because it's my also my work. I really want to acknowledge and make visible these practices, diverse practices, sustain such diversity of our fermented foods, because I believe strongly without these practices, we cannot nurture and sustain like microbial diversity of foods. For me, this side story is quite important to see results from that.
And for me, I mean, I guess my role in the trip served its purpose. I handed in, I think, around 200 photos over to KU and Veronica's department. And it was amazing. I mean, we're also still working through all of this together. We just published an article with Serviette magazine, which I really loved. It was a fantastic process getting to write all together. And the editor was fantastic too, Danielle. And hopefully we'll get to take some of those same stories to Slow Food next year. That's also on the radar. And a little bit of this, I think, will end up in the book I'm writing about fermentation under the section of attraction. I have some kind of lofty concepts, spontaneity, persistence, and there's also a section on attraction, like why species come together to form unions at all. And I think that the stories that I was privy to and got to experience and reenact with Sevgi's family and Sevgi and Veronica, and just going to Bulgaria and seeing all this firsthand, really speak to that because it was so tightly knit.
You mentioned all the media that you produced, David, which is actually not 200 photos, but also some pretty hefty video footage and audio clips. My hope is that as some of the science behind the surfaces and as we clarify the practice and the steps in making the yogurt and some more of the history behind it, that this collectively can be translated to the public, where that media, the photos and the video of placing the yogurt in the mounds are a window to understand the connection of microbial diversity in foods and in the environment and how they impact health, and whether that comes in a pop-up exhibition at a museum here in Copenhagen. I know Sevgi has talked about having this in Bulgaria or Turkey, where these practices originate from. I think that would be really powerful. Or if it would just come on some type of online platform that was accessible to people, specifically not only in English, but in Turkish and Bulgarian. I think those are some longer term aims of the project, but they require a few steps to happen first.
That sounds fantastic. Are there any final thoughts that any of you want to share?
I would say it's all the people that are really set in their one discipline, particularly if there are any scientists listening to this, to remember to step back and listen and observe what's happening in your environment and recognize that learning doesn't just come from data and controlled, objective, scientific pursuits, but it is embedded in culture and embedded in the ants crawling in your kitchen or your own backyard. I certainly, you know, a year and a half ago when I met Sevgi, I never thought that I would find out the ants and their microbes are really important to food and culture and even considered sacred in some cases to different people around the world. So it's opened up a whole new way of thinking and learning and observing and generating knowledge for me. Keep your eyes open.
Thank you so much for joining us for our conversation with Veronica and Sevgi. To see updates and photos of their trip and for information on the speaker series, you can visit goto.stanford.edu/fermentationseries or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine and sign up for updates. For more interviews like this one, you can subscribe on Spotify. If you have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you. So email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support. See you soon.